65. That sets a Masters record for the largest lead at the halfway point of golf's first Masters tournament of the year. He is 12 under for the tournament. McIlroy will tee off this afternoon at 2:50 Eastern time in the coveted final pairing of the day. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. This is NPR.
Well, welcome to The Conversation on WVIK. It's a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Robin Johnson from Heartland Politics. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll stick around for this week's Conversation on WVIK. Well, Robin Johnson, I've been looking forward to this because you are a voice that is familiar to many here in the Quad Cities, but you're usually the guy who's asking the questions. So we're going to turn the tables now, and I want to learn some things about you. So thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I'm looking forward to it as well.
We're grateful to have you. Now, you're going to find out if you haven't already deduced it. I am incurably nosy. And because of that, I have to always start my conversations by asking my guests a little bit about where they grew up and eventually how they got where they're going. But even though you have been a great gift to the community of Monmouth, Illinois, which we'll get to in a minute, I have to say your accent betrays you. Your accent places you, 200, 250 miles more to the northeast of Monmouth. Am I getting that somewhat right?
Very good. Yes, I was actually born in Chicago and lived about the first 10 years of my life there. And my parents were originally from this area, so they decided to move back. I spent the first years of my life up in Chicago going to public schools.
Well, that's where it comes from then. And I would have sworn it was probably more than 10 years. But so that explains, though, how you got then to Monmouth. What brought your parents back there? You said that they had some roots there, but what was it that precipitated the move?
Actually, my dad was involved in the railway clerks union, and he lost an election. And it was at that point that they looked to either, and also the neighborhood was changing some, and they were looking to move into the suburbs. And after some trips down to see their parents, we kind of liked the area down here. That was in about 1967 when crime was becoming more of an issue in the inner city where we lived and all. And I think my parents were just looking for some alternatives to being in the city. And so it was either the suburbs or down here, and they decided to come down here because I think we, as kids, my older brother and younger sister and I kind of liked it down here. Of course, it was totally different. People very friendly. So that's kind of what brought us back here. My dad found work and my mom stayed home to raise the kids at first until my sister got older.
Well, I will say in my experiences in Monmouth, Illinois, the people still are pretty doggone friendly. So that's a nice little thing. But they've also got a fantastic liberal arts college there, and you've got some association with that, including being an alum.
Yeah, I graduated from Monmouth in 1980, 4 years. I got my degree in 4 years, which seems pretty rare anymore. And I was asked to consider teaching part-time in 2000, and I did so. And I've been, for the most part, there was a couple of years in there, I think around 2003, 2002, when they didn't need me. But for the most part, since 2000, I've taught one or two classes there every semester. And I would add that Monmouth is also where I met you. You came down and was a guest pastor at our church, First Lutheran Church in Monmouth. And I don't know if that was in the late 80s or 90s or when, but I remember at the early service, you came in and gave a very good sermon. And I remember meeting you outside on my way out. So that's when we met as well.
Well, as a person, and I love the very prosaic way that sometimes clergy talk about it, pulpit supply. You know, it's
pulpit supply. Yeah,
slightly. well, I'd say considerably less valuable than plumbing supply, but pulpit supply. And when a pastor has to be gone, and if I recall correctly, Monmouth had a legendary pastor named Constant Johnson. Was that were those days then, or?
No, this was, I can't remember the pastor. We moved here and Raymond Swanson was the minister, and he retired soon after. And then it was Jerry Youngquist.
Of course.
And his son is my neighbor where I live right now out in the country. Yeah. And so then we had David Johnson after that. I don't know if you were there when Youngquist was minister or not. But
well,
yeah, pulpit supply. That's kind of a strange term.
And of course, when I would show up, usually the pastor was gone, and that's why I was there. So, I'll tell you, I don't do much of that anymore, but my only mark of success, I'm glad it seemed not offensive to you, is as long as I wasn't struck by lightning or turned into a pillar of salt, I figure, I did okay, right? So.
And I shouldn't say this, but I will. You may not like it, but what I remembered was I was leaving. You were outside, and we spoke briefly, and I told you how much I liked the sermon, but you were smoking a cigarette.
Oh, those awful days. Well, you know, Luther himself said, simil justus et peccator. Simultaneously saint and sinner, and I was in heavy doses of the latter in those days, but I'm fortunate that I moved beyond that. Boy, it's been quite a few years now. But, well, you know, I made my career in radio, and you survive on macaroni and cheese and stimulants, I mean, basically, at least in public radio at the time, right? It was it's a beautiful church. It's a historic part of the old Augustana Synod. Scattered houses of worship all over the place, sometimes two in the same community. I mean, you got Galesburg, where you got Trinity and First, basically a block apart from each other. But wherever you've got a town with Scandinavian Lutherans in one congregation, don't hold your breath. It's going to be two. And then three, and then so on and so forth. But thank you for dredging that up.
Sure.
I sure enjoyed it. And it was always great to drive to Monmouth. The college there is slightly different, different, but proud, equally proud ethnic identity, the Scots of Monmouth College. What was your major as an undergrad?
I majored in government. They don't have that anymore. It's political science. But I majored in government. They had the old trimester system where they had, instead of semesters, they had three semesters. And they changed now to semesters since I left as well. But we're called the Fighting Scots, not just the Scots, the Fighting Scots. So, Monmouth is a good school. I felt like I got a good education there. The reason I like it, and I think the reason a lot of students like it now, is the faculty to student ratio. You can get to know your professors. In most cases, that's a good thing. I teach 15 students. That's my limit, and that's usually how many I have. And it allows you the opportunity to get to know them and really work with them to help them if they need it. And I just can't imagine kids going to bigger universities where there's, you know, maybe 100 students taking a class. I mean, if that's what they enjoy, that's great. I wouldn't judge it. But for me, I think that's one of the endearing things about Monmouth, Augustana, other smaller colleges, is that opportunity for the faculty to get to know the students well.
Well, I tell you, Robin, I've been around a lot of families for years making decisions like that. And what I found is one of the first things that a young person will decide, even before they can give voice to the question, is how big. It tends that I think males are more attracted to anonymity and going to a larger place where people aren't paying close attention to them. That's a broad stereotype. I mean, our schools enroll quite a few males, and that's why we have football teams. But there's also another way to decide that is, I do want to be known. I want to be supported and all that kind of stuff. When you mention the Fighting Scots, and I do apologize for getting that wrong, but it's interesting how times change. The very first mention of a athletic moniker for Augustana was the Terrible Swedes of Augustana. I think it was in a dispatch article from Moline, and they called them the Terrible Swedes of Augustana. And eventually that settled down, maybe, I guess, to Vikings. And we'll ride that pony for a while now.
I've heard Swedes described a lot of ways, but not terrible.
Oh, yeah. That's. I'm very grateful we don't have to fit that onto basketball jerseys. That would be a little bit of a pain in the tuchus. But you mentioned the trimester system. My experience with that was it allowed for a lot of experimentation. So you might have a major, but you had a chance to really dive deep into a lot of other subjects. Was that your case? And if so, what subjects did you find yourself gravitating towards?
Oh, I loved, I took a lot of courses in economics, and I took a lot of courses in history. Of course, it was a liberal arts school, so I took a lot of other classes like art history and all that. I'll tell you, with age, I've come to appreciate classes like that more. And I would just say probably the best thing that I remember about the trimester system is we would be done with the first of three trimesters right before Thanksgiving. And then you get 6 weeks off. And you'd go back right in early January, and you'd go for the second of the three trimesters and be done. Oh, I think it was maybe late March, early April, but then you wouldn't finish up till late May. So that was an interesting aspect of it as well. Yeah, I took a lot of courses outside of my major in economics and history. We had some outstanding professors. And it's honestly, Kai, it's where I was brought up in a as I mentioned, my dad was a union president, and I was brought up in a Democratic household. Mm-hmm. But I remember, and for the audience, I mean, this is what we need more of now, I think. But I remember hearing my government professor, Roy McClenock, who was an old New Deal liberal Democrat, talking about the need for government and what government can do to help people. My next class in those afternoons would be Rod Lemon, who just passed away, unfortunately, my economics professor, who did some work, I believe, for the Reagan administration. But he brought a more free market, classical free market view on limited government. And so I could go listen to both sides of this and kind of make my own mind up. And that's one of the reasons I think I've carried that with me, is that I still read every day. I'll read the New York Times opinion section, and I'll read the Wall Street Journal opinion section, and find a little bit of truth in both. And I think maybe that's what's lacking a little bit. I wouldn't recommend everybody go out and do like I do, which is crazy to read the number of newspapers I do. Hmm. But I'm just I thirst for information still on what people are thinking, who may not think the way I do. But I think that's something that Monmouth gave me that was just priceless. And it was a major element of the formation of my views. And that served me in my political career and as a radio host.
And we're going to get to that. But I got to say, I flatter myself we have something in common there. I like to start my day with those two publications, but I try as much as possible to stay away from the opinion pages. I like journalism, and they're both very good journalistic outfits. I get a newsletter from each. I will say one exception to that rule is the New York Times, when Brett Stevens, and more recently he's been doing this with Bruni, they have the conversation, and it's you get a lefty and a righty. And of course, I think Brett is a little bit interesting because a lot of his views get skewed by other facets than domestic politics in the United States. But it's an interesting conversation, and it's a great way when to start the day.
I love Brett Stevens. I've been reading him since he was a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and he moved over to the Times maybe 5 years ago.
I really miss Michael Gershon. I don't know if you remember him from the Washington Post, but he was a Wheaton grad from Wheaton, Illinois. I mean, Illinois is Wheaton, and was very, very much very serious about his evangelical roots. Unfortunately, he passed away. I think he would be appalled. That's what's being done in the name of evangelicalism these days and sort of a nationalist Christianity. But he was one of the great thinkers I think we ever had. Very conservative.
I've started, in fact, on top of all the reading I have, I've started, it was about 5 years ago, I think. My brother, when I would go visit him, he lives in New Jersey. He's been a longtime subscriber to the Financial Times, which is, of course, based in Great Britain. And I saw somebody, actually, it was John McCain's son, Jack McCain, who I follow on Twitter, made a comment that he felt like the Financial Times reporting was some of the most objective reporting that he had read. And I'm an old school, all the president's men type. I just want the facts a lot of times on my journalism. I don't want the opinion mixed in it. I mean, I love to read opinion pieces on both sides, but for a story on what happened, I want straight news. And so I started just subscribing to the Financial Times, and it is excellent. The icing on the cake is you kind of get to see how the rest of the world, especially Europeans, are viewing us. And some of their opinion columnists, who I had never heard of, are just outstanding. Yeah. And so it's just more to read every day, but I love it.
Well, I probably will have to give up this subscription at some point, but I love my Economist for the same reasons. Yep. I get to, there's a story about Malawi, and maybe I wasn't thinking about that in the previous 12, 18 months, but if I read it, I'm going to learn something. Yeah. And that's a great way to go. So, well, I was going to say, clearly you're a curious, you're a person driven by curiosity, which is fantastic. Did that somehow lead to this harebrained scheme of doing a public radio show? I mean, that's not a terrible growth industry right now these days, but.
You know, if there's one thing I tell my students is be open to all possibilities. I mean, if somebody would have said I'd be teaching part-time when I was in college, that would have been just hilarious. If somebody would have said 20 years ago, you're going to host a radio show, I would say that's crazy. It was just circumstances that led to it. I was at a conference in Chicago. I saw a friend of mine, Rick Pearson, who writes for the Chicago Tribune. He was hosting a show, Sunday morning show on WGN called Sunday Spin. And we were just talking, having an adult beverage and at a nice restaurant. And he said, you know, you ought to do this. And I said, I don't know. So I was taking the train back, and John Pritchard, who owns several radio stations in Galesburg and Burlington, I mentioned it to him. And he said, you would be good at it. And he said, you want to try it? And I said, well, yeah, why not? So in 2014, I started at KBUR. And did a weekly show. And during COVID, they had to, the station had to cut back, and I was led to Jay Pierce and Jared Johnson there with WVIK. And they were anxious to pick me up when they found out I was a booker. I've never been called a booker before. But apparently, that's somebody that reads a lot of books. I started in the fall of 2020. And I've really enjoyed it. WVIK is, I think, just a perfect fit for, I guess, my approach to interviews.
Well, I can't let it rest, but I mean, I think on a resume, Booker looks better than Bookie. I mean, possibly.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Or there's other initials you could put there that are less flattering.
Well, okay. For those who have not discovered it, and I don't know who they might be, but Heartland Politics, you can hear on WVIK Friday nights at 8:30, Saturdays at 4 p.m. You can always check it out on the WVIK app or at WVIK.org. And honestly, what I really love about it, Robin, is that you will take on national and sometimes international issues or things with international ramifications, but you do give it a nice, sensical Western Illinois approach. And I really enjoy that. I mean, is that something that you have to practice as you're reading the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, and that sort of thing?
I just try, I guess, having lived in this area most of my life, I try to figure out what are the key issues out here. And I try to just put myself in the listener's shoes, so to speak, and what would they want to know? And a lot of times I don't ask some of the hot button issues going on because I feel like there's other issues that to me are more vital. And a lot of those are economic issues. And so that's kind of where I start from. As far as my style, I'll never forget this, Kai. I mean, I don't know. One of my first guests was former Senator Rick Santorum. We had the Iowa caucuses coming up. And if you remember, there were 17 candidates ultimately running. And this is the one where Trump won. He won the nominations. Cruz won the Iowa caucuses. But anyway, I had read Rick Santorum's book, Blue Collar Conservatives. And it was an interesting book. But I was interviewing him about the book. And he made a comment that Barack Obama came from a radical family. And I said, well, how do you define that? And he said, well, his dad was a communist. And I thought that was just an absolutely insane statement. And I try to keep my politics out of my shows. I feel hopefully that I do well with that. But right when that split second, I had to think, do I challenge this or do I let it go and just trust my listeners to deign whichever way they felt on it? And I chose the latter. I just thought, if people want the mudslinging and screaming and yelling and arguing, I mean, there's MSNBC, there's Fox, yeah. there's a lot of sources for that. I just thought for public radio, and now that I'm on public, I just felt like that fits my character better. Let people decide. I mean, I felt Barack Obama, whether you liked him or hated him, and I'm somewhere in between, that's an essential American story, his rise to be president. There aren't many countries where you could have that. And that should be celebrated, I think. And again, people are free to disagree with his policies. But I just felt like his dad was a communist was something not befitting a former U.S. senator. But it's his opinion, and that's where I kind of adopted the style I brought to this.
The proximity to the Iowa caucuses, and it's changing, of course, but that was always a great lure for getting very interesting students coming to the WVIK newsroom, even if they weren't journalism majors, but they wanted to be close to that energy, that activity, and go to a place where you could be in a small room and, you know, there's Alexander Haig or Vice President Bush when George H.W. was running back in the day. And it was always fun to have that going on. But along the way, between your teaching and everything else, you got really well connected with a wide range of people. And we're going to talk about some of those guests that you've had recently. I will say you've had a couple of shows lately where you've taken on really thought-provoking books, talking with their authors. And it's great to have your take on that. I don't want to spill any beans, but do you know who's going to be on next for you?
Let's see. This week, I've got the author of a book on Shay's Rebellion.
Ah.
What led to that? Just the whole issue of dissent in our country, but also how far it goes before it starts infringing on order. I mean, and Shay's Rebellion, the Whiskey Rebellion, were the early parts of our country's history. And I what I love about working for first Jay and then Jared, they just let me go wherever I want to go here with this. And I follow where my interests are.
Sure.
And it just seemed like this was an opportune time. We've had the tragedy up in Minnesota. Yeah. We had the Black Lives Matter protests. We had the January 6th protests.
Robin, we're gonna get to all that in a minute. I'm just having so much fun. I lost track of time. But now's the time I'm going to tell you. You're talking to Robin Johnson from Heartland Politics. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Conversation on WVIK.
Support for WVIK comes from the Jewish Federation of the Quad Cities, presenting Violins of Hope, a traveling exhibit of violins connected to the Holocaust, displayed at the Putnam Museum, the Figge Art Museum, and the German-American Heritage Center. More at violinsofhopeiowa.com.
Find out what's going on this weekend with What's Happening QC, your source for local events and fun in the Quad Cities, made possible by Seifert Building Supplies. Fridays at 2:01 p.m. on WVIK News, and you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. What's happening,
Hi, I'm Scott Tunnicliffe. I'm from the Quad Cities, lived here all my life. And WVIK is my not-for-profit NPR station.
And we're back. Thank you for sticking with us, friends. This is The Conversation on WVIK, and a guest I've really been looking forward to visiting with, Robin Johnson. He's the host of Heartland Politics, which you can hear on WVIK, thanks to the foresight of a hero to many of us, Jay Pierce. And I tell you what, Robin, I mean, you know how colleges and universities work here. My job is sometimes described as the director of what's left over. As a presidential assistant. And there was a time in 2011 that we needed to make a change in the leadership of WVIK that was running up a very serious deficit. And my job was to, just as my boss said, get the boat back on its bottom. And I did that just enough to attract the attention of a genius named Jay Pierce. Do you remember how you first met Jay?
I first met Jay through a connection with R.C. I forgot his last name. He runs the stations over in Bloomington and Peoria.
Okay.
And RC, I had met through some other connections, and when I talked to him, he said you'd be a perfect fit with WVIK, and he set up a Zoom session. I still remember Jay, Jared, RC, and I were on that. That's how I first met Jay. And then after, I was so delighted to work at WVIK that I came up. And I remember meeting Jay in person at lunch with Jay and Jared and myself at a place across the river in Davenport. So just delightful. I think we got together one more time before he got sick. Just an incredible person, human being.
Well, before the break, you mentioned Rick Santorum. I got to share a story here is that related to the Iowa caucuses, whatever year Pat Buchanan made a more serious run, and I don't know if it was 88 challenging HW or maybe 92, I don't know when it was, but our local PBS channel had a wonderful journalist named Susan McBride, and she couldn't be there. She liked to interview any one of the folks coming for the caucuses, and the day that Buchanan was coming, she was going to be out of town. So she said, Kai, would you fill in here? Now, trust me on this, friends, I got a face made for radio. I'm much better suited to radio, but they put a tie on me, and I sat in the studios and I interviewed the guy. And the guy, you know, he prides himself on being a scholar from a good, strong Jesuit institution where they're rigorous in teaching you, Georgetown. And he studied history there. And he goes off about how, and this is true to his brand, America has only been best served by isolationism. And whenever it steps away from that, gets into trouble. And I happen to mention, do you think that was true of us leaving Versailles when we did? And he goes on and talks about his next three campaign appearances. When the cameras were off, and like you, I said, I better just let him go with this. I'm not going to challenge him. When the cameras are off, he looked at me and said, you had me on Versailles. And I thought, doggone it, why didn't you say that while the cameras were rolling? So on this show, which, I mean, this is not really a political program, The Conversation. We just try to be interesting. But if I hear some, what one friend of mine calls fooly-wang, I'll probably lift it up. And don't worry, I'm not going to hear that from Robin Johnson because I'm used to listening to him on Heartland Politics. So now that you've mentioned a couple of interesting guests and the author that you mentioned that we'll hear next Friday at 8:30 p.m. sounds fascinating. But do you have like some favorite conversations that you've had since doing Heartland Politics? Some that just stand out? I know everyone is the favorite, but...
Well, I would say generally, I enjoy talking with authors more, because a lot of times with candidates, it's talking points. I've worked in campaigns. I know how it works. They do polling, they test messages, then you hear it. And I do try to poke around a little bit to see exceptions or anything, but most of them are pretty good. They're not going to. They're not going to stray too much from the talking points. So I find authors a lot more interesting. I'm fascinated by our culture and the intersection between politics and culture. Of course, a lot of people say culture is politics and vice versa. But if I find authors on like the impacts of TV, or a radio or anything like that. There was one author that wrote about the 1970s and its impact on our culture. That's when I was in high school and college. Books like that. I'm just fascinated in the change in our politics, the realignment since Donald Trump has come on the scene. I think the shifting of the working class voters from the Democratic Party to Republicans is very interesting to me because I grew up as in a working class family. So anything that shines light on that and kind of makes sense of where we're at, what's going on, because I think this is a historic period in our country's history. That's what I try to do. So if I find authors that I think take a particular angle on this that maybe people haven't heard, I'll get them on. And then I think I'm just circling all the above here, but I love going back and looking at history. You mentioned isolationism. I managed to get H.W. Brands on, the noted historian, one of the best in the country, to talk about his book on Roosevelt and Lindbergh. And I read more about Lindbergh's theory, and, you know, there was a part of it that made a lot of sense. I understand where they were coming from for the first time in my life. I don't agree with it, but I understand it better. We got two big oceans. Why should we want to be messing around what's right. going on overseas? Right. Okay. But that's a long answer to your question. And I mean, I could pick out individuals that I've enjoyed over the years. Bill Medley from the Righteous Brothers, that he had a fascinating story to tell about singing in the 1960s and how the radio show host thought he and Bobby Hatfield were African-American when they heard him sing until they came into the studio. I found that interview fascinating. Of course, Tom Brokaw, I got to interview, and he was one of my heroes from the 1970s journalism. Those are a couple, I guess. I mean, I could go on, but I think just the ones that explore our culture are the ones I find the most fascinating.
Yeah, I'm involved in local politics myself in Rock Island County. Just so you know, you are stuck talking to a politician now, but I completely agree. I'd rather any day talk to an author. And I know that a lot of the authors you have on are great scholars who do wonderful nonfiction work. But you ever have any time for fiction? Is there something like that catches your fancy?
You know, I spent a summer during COVID reading a whole bunch of Philip Roth.
Mm.
I thought he was very interesting. But for the most part, people recommend fiction works to me all the time. And I just have too many books.
Yep.
I've got a stack I'm looking at right now that just historical periods or people that I look at and want to try to read first. So, yeah, I stick mostly to nonfiction.
Well, my love of history, I will always gravitate towards that. I just got my son a copy of The History of the World in 12 Shipwrecks. A book that I read about from The Economist. But there's something about, at least for me, I need the fiction. So we've got a group of friends here at Augustana where we have one rule for our book club, and it's got to be fiction. So I think that speaks to different parts of the brain. You talked about some great guests you've had. Do you have any bucket list guests, folks that you'd really like to get on the show?
Boy, I've never been asked that. You know, I've been able to have, again, and you mentioned it having the station be in the Quad Cities and before that Burlington, I've had most of the major presidential campaigns on. I mean, I had Donald Trump on, which was an interesting experience. I had Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and that's all great. I mean, I would love to get Trump back on, and I've tried. One thing I've learned on this radio show and getting guests to talk to my class, you got to ask. And most of the time, believe it or not, they'll accommodate you. I think it's always an honor to interview presidents and United States senators. I got Bernie on. But yeah, I guess I'm not coming up with a big bucket list off the top of my head of people I'd like to have. Again, I just kind of go where the path, my intellectual curiosity takes me. And sometimes I wind up in surprising places.
Well, I think that's a fantastic answer. And I recall that when I was in the newsroom here back in the 80s and early 90s, there were many times I talked to the press folks from somebody, and I would modulate my voice to say that I'm from the NPR affiliate. So, I mean, if they just heard NPR, that's fine. As you know, not the local stuff. Well, my guest is Robin Johnson. You know him from Heartland Politics, which is a fantastic program that we get to share with you on WVIK. One of several good ones that we like to share. There's another little capsule we often like to share. And if you're a regular listener, you know what I'm saying. It's time for Rock Island Lines with Roald Tweet.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. Within 10 miles of Rock Island, 493 restaurants lie in wait, menus at attention. 479 of these serve pizza, spaghetti, salmon and dill sauce, hot beef sandwiches, Iowa pork chops, pancakes, along with potatoes that are hashed, mashed, baked, creamed, or French, cottage, or home fried. Customers sit, order, eat, tip, and leave. The remaining 14 are small-town diners, seating an average of 34 customers apiece, except for Sunday noon, when they open the banquet room in back after church. These diners, with names like Vivian's, Deb's, or Adolph's, are the small stages on which are enacted the daily scenes of small-town life. As in church, food is only part of the liturgy. It is to these diners that the men come at 9:30 each morning, from tractors in the field, or from fixing cars or clerking hardware. They gather in a circle at the round center table for coffee and hot cinnamon rolls just out of the oven. But they are also here to debate last night's Cubs game, plan fishing trips, compare DeKalb with Northrop King. Shortly after 10, the women arrive and slide into booths along the wall for coffee and cookies. First the young mothers with babies and infants, then the few working women who get a break. They share the community news of marriages and deaths and births. They exchange suggestions for treating colds and rashes in children. The only men allowed to sit with the women are the town grocer and the occasional new groom who may come here with his wife for a month before returning to the circle of men. After that, he will nod at her as he leaves and she arrives. The women leave in time for the men to return at 11:30 for the $2.69 dinner, salad, meat, mashed potatoes, carrots, and rhubarb pie. Little talk here. Dinner is serious. The diners remain open until the kids coming home from school have stopped in for candy and a bottle of pop. By 4, the curtains will have come down, the day's play over. Actors and actresses scattered to their homes for supper and a night's sleep.
Rock Island Lines with Roald Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And you can hear it on WVIK thanks to folks just like you who've become members of this radio station. We're grateful to have the opportunity to air wonderful little tidbits like that, as well as get to know people like Robin Johnson, my guest today on The Conversation. He is the host of Heartland Politics, and it really is a lot of fun having you on, Robin. But I did just a little bit of snooping, and I know you've taught some very interesting classes during your time in the classroom at Monmouth, including one called Film and Politics. I got to hear about this. Of course, I imagine it's got to include Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, but what other films?
I found a textbook. I've only taught this course two or three times. Oh. I found a textbook that explored film and politics through the decades. So there would be one film, political film, per decade we would look at. And yes, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was one of them. So the course was structured. We would watch part of a film in class on Monday. I would lecture on that chapter on Wednesday. Or I'm sorry, Monday would be lecture day, Wednesday film day, Friday would be discussion day. The students would have to watch the rest of the film before then. And it was really interesting. Probably the most challenging thing was to pick out a film for each decade. Hmm. Of course, Dr. Strangelove for the 60s, The Candidate for the 70s, Wag the Dog, Lincoln. And then I started having students write up some more on their own. Watch films on their own to write up. But Yeah, it was very interesting, and it was really hard. I got in a lot of discussions with the college president at the time, Clarence Wyatt. He's like, oh, no, you got to use this film for the 60s. I'm like, well, hey, you know. So everybody had their own views of what the most significant film was each decade, which was interesting. Yeah, that was a fun class.
Do you ever do The Great Dictator?
No, I watched it, but we decided not to do it. We just didn't have the time. I did do one of the Chaplin movies on Hard Work. What was that called?
Modern
do you remember
Times?
That?
Was it?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you've chosen some winners. I mean, I just stumbled across Lincoln and I really was moved by it when it was out. And it, boy, does that, that's holding up, I think. And of course, whenever I get caught seeing Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, I can't resist. I still get a charge when I get a chance to travel to D.C. for work, or every year I take a small minivan full of students to Springfield and we go to Student Lobby Day. There is something exhilarating about trying to participate in representative democracy. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, we of course, Citizen Kane is considered the best film of all time. Mm-hmm. I've seen it several times. It's a good one, but I'm not sure it's the best. But we had students watch that. And then I had to be really careful because Birth of a Nation is considered such a significant film. But as you know, there's just some awful racist scenes in it. And I really went back and forth on it. I talked to the dean, the president of the college. It wound up, I talked to my class, my students, and I had, I think, one or two African-American students. They wanted to watch it. They wanted to draw their own opinions on it. And I really credit my students a lot for having the maturity to want to see it on their own.
Another very problematic film. I don't know if you've ever discussed Triumph of the Will, Leni Riefenstahl. That is not so much domestic politics, but it certainly shows about the politics of spectacle. I'm glad you mentioned The Candidate. That's one of the best last lines of any movie. I mean, it's up there with Bridge on the River Kwai's last line is madness, right? And for The Candidate, it's, well, now what?
Yep.
It's a great line. But are you still teaching?
Yeah, I'm teaching right now. I'm teaching a course on Midwest politics this semester, which is really, it's the only class I found when I first pitched this. You've got regional politics taught everywhere, like Southern politics, Northeast, Western. Nobody was teaching Midwest politics. So I proposed it, and Monmouth, just great. They give me a lot of leeway, and I proposed it. They went along with it, and I've been teaching that, you know, for probably 12 years. And it's lined up with the advent of Donald Trump winning the presidency and winning through the blue wall states, of which Pennsylvania, not Midwestern, but Western Pennsylvania could qualify as Midwestern. So we've looked a lot at what happened in Iowa, for example, which was the purple state, which Obama won twice and then turned and voted for Trump, and right along the river here, these river counties. Yeah. So I've had a key element of this is understanding the impact of globalization on our region, which I think is the key issue involving trade, factories going overseas, immigration. But also relating it, I have students follow counties and how they voted over the years, but also their mix of economic and demographic information to get them to understand what happened, what's happening, and why. Because, again, it's a very historical period, and whatever you think of Trump and the Democrats, my goal is to make students understand this better and look at real-life election returns in these key counties across the Midwest.
I'm just waiting. There's going to have to be a flood of master's dissertations on the Illinois-Iowa divide and how the two states differentiated over the course of, well, from Reagan, we'll say, until the present time. If you talk to Don Wooten, he'll say the Koch brothers had something to do with that. I don't know if you buy into that theory at all, but they had an experiment. They wanted to see if they could turn a purple state bright flaming red, and it seems like that it worked.
Well, the thing that people need to realize is the change in our voting and the realignment started happening before Trump. I think in Iowa, in my opinion, it went back to 2014, and Tom Harkin his seat, which he retired, and Braley and Joni Ernstrand. That's when you first started seeing the change in voting to me. And in a lot of counties that were traditionally Democratic flipping. So I think it started prior to Trump. Trump certainly taken advantage of this trend played on, I think, working class fears with his language. I remember hearing him on satellite radio during the campaign talking about trade and infrastructure. And I thought, this guy's going to do well out here. And he has. And it's Sherry Bustos' district. Sherry was a dear friend of mine. I helped her a lot in her campaigns, early campaigns especially. I think 9 out of her 11 counties were Obama-Trump counties. Mm-hmm. So we're right in the middle of this. And that's why it's so important to understand it and research it and study it. And good Lord, all the books, I think I've read all of them trying to explain this.
What do you make of, and I haven't thought about this deeply, but Rock Island County and Scott County have a lot of similarities despite being in two different states and some significant differences, right? But what do you think, what do you make of that divide right there between these two adjacent counties? Both are tend to be more towards the middle than any extreme, but one tilts left and one has been okay tilting right.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've done a little research on those two because Rock Island County is losing population. And I mean, my good friend, the late Porter McNeil, I had this discussion with him several times that should be a matter of urgency in the county. It should be studied. Why are people leaving? A lot of them, from what I hear anecdotally anyway, are going across the river to Iowa. Is it because of taxes? Is it because of schools? What is the reason? There is a lot in common. There's no question, I think. The organized laborers had a lot of strength in both counties. And culturally, they're very similar, I think. But the incomes tend to be higher. And I think there's a higher college graduation rate across the river as well, which, of course, is playing a bigger role in voting. So, there's a lot to be learned in comparing those two counties and doing some more, intensive look at what's going on. I think the education divide probably explains more than anything.
And I don't know, I would have to posit, though, and there's an Augustana prof who's working on some of the statistical data, but there was a point of inflection in the mid-70s where there was some racial tension in the Illinois Quad Cities, especially in Rock Island, where I'm proudly a hometown boy, and you just saw this flight of those educated. You probably, if you looked at educational attainment in 1974, I bet you it tilted towards the Illinois side, and it was just that quick of a light switch. We do like to keep people going back and forth across the river, so as I remind you, we're listening to Robin Johnson, host of Heartland Politics. I did want to make note of something that's really kind of fun and very Midwestern. But Asbury United Methodist Church over in Bettendorf is having one of its community hymn sings. And if you can't agree on anything else, well, music will make you agree on at least some form of tonality. And that's going to be Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. They'll be doing some old favorites, some new things, and the wonderful John Fouts, retired music educator from Augustana, will be there as well, free of charge. Come on over. It is openly non-denominational and an all-age group event. So that's why I tee that up, Bo Robin, is you get to live in Monmouth, which is kind of an idyllic setting, and yet you can have a focus that is absolutely global. The people that you bring to our ears and our airwaves, it's remarkable, but then you get all the benefits. And I think you mentioned you're a little bit outside of town now.
Yeah, I'm out in the country.
All right.
Yeah. And my neighbor, I've got good neighbors out here, and through the miracle of modern technology and again, some great bosses, WVAK, I get to do this show. I get to keep teaching part-time in addition to the things that actually pay the bills more. So I feel very blessed, honestly, to work with WVAK and Augustana College. It's been a great partnership, and I just feel really lucky to be able to do that. I continue to just be driven by intellectual curiosity on things and just wherever that path goes. I just did a couple shows on books about the two most consequential U.S. senators from each party this century, Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid. I thought that was very interesting, their similarities and differences. So that's the fun part of what I do.
Well, this is a shot entirely in the dark, but in talking about Monmouth, I'm reminded I had a friend from many years ago, a guy named John Benke. Did you happen to know any of the Benkes?
Yeah. I went to high school. We graduated high school together.
Well, that's then our shared claim to fame. John managed to win a Student Academy Award for best documentary about the one and only Norma Jean Elephant in Oquaka. Now, did your travels ever take you to Oquaka?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. John was just a very talented, creative person. I'm not surprised by that at all. I think we were co-editor of the paper one year. He was in the plays, and I did a little of that, but he was just a very, very creative person, and I'm sure he's had success, whatever he's done in his career. I haven't talked to him or had any contact with him.
To tell you the truth, neither have I, but we have a mutual friend. I think John is angling towards retirement if he hasn't already been there, but I'll never forget, he did something genius with this documentary on this wonderful story of an elephant being struck by lightning and left behind by its circus on the banks of the Mississippi in Oquaka. But when he put that together, he had a good idea of talking to the then editor of the Oquaka Current, which I don't even know if it's still around anymore, but it really gave you a insight into the importance of a journalist, even in a small, small town.
Yeah, that's one of the most frightful aspects of what's going on in our world right now is the loss of community journalism. I just really worry about that. And also just some of my students tell me that they don't read books. They haven't read much. And we really, really need to get things turned around, public education, and get kids reading more and exploring more and get some ways of getting community news back. So old-fashioned objective journalism.
Well, and I got to tell you, I'm on a county board here, and the elected folks behave differently when there's a journalist in the room. And as a former journalist, I want them in the room, but they generally won't cover because their staffs are so tightly winnowed down and stretched so far. Then the alternative is my spouse gets to serve on a city council where they stream the meetings. And I'm not sure that's the best idea because you get people who want to have 3 minutes of screaming knowing that 14 of their fellow residents are watching the same thing. So I'm not sure what the answer is, but I do know that democracy requires a public being able to find out what's going on. And short of those ways of doing it and listening to Robin Johnson and similar shows on public radio, how do you make sure that's that flag is being waved in Monmouth, Robin?
Our paper. We used to have a paper 6 days a week. I think it comes out once a week now. The Register Mail used to have circulation here. I used to subscribe to it. They had some outstanding journalists there back in the day. It's just hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's why that's why I think part of the partisan divide is because we're now tuning into news that's national and it's dividing us without getting to the objective journalism locally. I remember, like you said, I remember when I was on the Monmouth City Council for 4.5 years in the late 90s, there was an outstanding reporter who covered our meetings from the Galesburg Register Mail. She was good.
Yeah.
And you weren't going to get away with anything.
Exactly.
And I'm glad. I'm glad it made me a better public official.
Well, guess what? These two public officials have to step aside because we're out of time. Robin Johnson, host of the Heartland Politics show and podcast. Thanks for being with us today. And I'll be with you in just a second, Robin. But right now, I got to tell my friends that you can catch the conversation twice each week on WVIK. Saturdays, of course, like you just did. And then right after Fresh Air on Monday evenings. From the campus of Augustana College, this is Kai Swanson inviting you to join us next week for the conversation.
You've been listening to The Conversation on WVIK. If you missed part of it or just want to hear it again, tune in at 8 o'clock on Monday evening, right here on WVIK. Support for WVIK comes from the Jewish Federation of the Quad Cities, presenting Violins of Hope, including performances by the Quad City Symphony Orchestra, Ballet Quad Cities, and others, incorporating playable Holocaust-era violins. More at violinsofhopeiowa.com.
I'm Naomi. WFK is my PR station.
With national and international news at the top of every hour and local news throughout your day, we're WVIK, 90.3 FM and HD Rock Island, and at 95.9 FM, K240DZ Dubuque, WVIK, Quad Cities NPR.